Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. This program is part of our Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Julia Flynn Seiler, author of The House of Mondavi, The Rise and Fall of an American Wine Dynasty. It's my pleasure to introduce Jay McInerney, wine writer, author of Bright Lights, Big City, and his most recent book of short stories, How It Ended. Mr. McInerney's 1984 debut novel, Bright Lights, Big City, is a hilarious and poignant coming-of-age story about a young man navigating his way through New York's party scene, fueled by Bolivian marching powder and his ambition to rise above his job as a magazine fact-checker. Since then, Mr. McInerney has written seven other books of fiction, including The Story of My Life, which introduced the party girl character of Allison Poole, Brightness Falls, the story of a Manhattan couple named Corrine and Russell Calloway, and The Good Life, set in the aftermath of 9/11. His work explores themes of pleasure-seeking, materialism, and sexual betrayal, usually among characters from the moneyed classes. Mr. McInerney's life own life could come from one of his books. He lives in New York and is a Page Six regular. He recently married his fourth wife, Anne Hurst, who is here today, at the New York's 21 Club after meeting her at the nightclub Nell's. He's a self-described hedonist whose social life is perhaps even more interesting than some of his characters, including bedding down with a pot-bellied pig at night. The pig, for a time, slept between him and his third wife. His life as a bon vivant has led him to wine writing, where he's brought a refreshingly literary approach as a columnist for House and Garden magazine. Two books grew out of that, Bacchus and Me and Hedonists in the Cellar. And his latest work is a collection of short stories called How It Ended. And it will be the subject of this coming Sunday's cover story in the New York Times Book Review. Here we go. In it, Mr. McInerney returns to some of the same themes and characters in the stories from his novels spanning more than two decades of his work. And in that New York Times review, Sam Tenenhaus writes that with this book, Mr. McInerney has made a major literary contribution and, quote, revitalized the Irish Catholic expiatory tradition of F. Scott Fitzgerald and John O'Hara, with its emphasis not only on guilt, but also on shame. The collection's first story, titled It's 6 a.m., Do You Know Where You Are?, was his first published story and became the basis for Bright Lights, Big City. And I'd like to begin today by asking Mr. McInerney to read the first paragraph of that story, since the distinct voice he displays in it is one of the reasons he is being hailed as one of our generation's finest writers.
All right. I think I can manage that. This actually... can I give you a little context for
sure.
This?
Please do.
The first... First four or five lines of this story actually were scrawled down at about 4 or 5 a.m. after a very late night at a Manhattan nightclub, and I put them away in my drawer and didn't think of them again for 5 or 6 months until I got a phone call from George Plimpton, who's the editor of the Paris Review, among many other distinctions. And I had sent off another story to the Paris Review some weeks before. And, of course, I thought somebody was pulling my legs. Jay, George Plimpton here. And I couldn't quite believe it was George Plimpton, but indeed he eventually convinced me that he was. And he was interested in the story that I had sent him, but he hadn't quite made up his mind whether he was going to publish it. So I said I would send some other work as well. And I then went through everything that I had written up to that point and realized that it was all derivative and subpar. And there was only one thing that interested me in my drawer, and that was this paragraph that I had written down some months before, written in the second person. There were three or four lines, and I ended up sitting down that night and writing 12 more pages, and I sent it off to the Paris Review the next day. And it became then my first published story. And here's the first paragraph. It's 6 a.m., do you know where you are? I didn't need reading glasses back then. You're not the kind of guy who would be at a place like this at this time of the morning. But here you are, and you cannot say that the terrain is entirely unfamiliar, although the details are a little fuzzy. You are at a nightclub talking to a girl with a shaved head. The club is either the Bimbo Box or the Lizard Lounge. It might all come clearer if you could slip into the bathroom and do a little more Bolivian marching powder. Then again, it might not. There is a small voice inside of you insisting that this epidemic lack of clarity is a result of too much of that already. But you are not yet willing to listen to that voice. The night has already turned on that imperceptible pivot where 2 a.m. changes to 6 a.m. You know that moment has come and gone, though you are not yet willing to concede that you have crossed the line beyond which all is gratuitous damage and the palsy of unraveled nerve endings. Somewhere back there, it was possible to cut your losses, but you rode past that moment on a comet trail of white powder, and now you are trying to hang on to the rush. Your brain at present is composed of brigades of tiny Bolivian soldiers. They are tired and muddy from their long march through the night. There are holes in their boots, and they are hungry. They need to be fed. They need the Bolivian marching powder.
That's great. Thank you.
I believe that's called a metaphor.
Well, that little scribbling that you did, it changed your life. I mean, that story became the book. The book became the movie with J. Michael Fox and Kiefer Sutherland.
It all started with a really disastrous trip to a nightclub where every single girl that I asked to dance turned me down.
Except for the bald girl?
I think there was a girl with a shaved head who was bartending that night. I think I was a little hard on the bald girl there, but.
So how did you handle the fame? It came very fast.
I suppose the short answer would be badly, but it was very strange because I'd been working in publishing for in a marginal capacity for a while, and I'd worked for Random House as a manuscript reader and a sort of gopher, and my best friend from Williams was an assistant editor at Random House, and I had watched many first novels get published and to a resounding lack of acclaim or echo by the time I published Bright Lights, I had such low expectations. I was hoping that I might get a few reviews and get an assistant professorship somewhere out of the deal. And so the book's success came as a big surprise. I mean, it started out slowly, though. And the New York Times took 3 months to review the book. And in the meantime, it sold out its first printing. And it had never occurred to Random House that it would sell out its first printing. And so they really hadn't thought about a second printing. So there was a good 4 or 5 weeks when the book was completely unavailable. And at a moment when it was becoming kind of a cult phenomenon. And it was a sort of not an overnight sensation. There was a slow build, but it still took me very much by surprise. Anybody who pursues a literary career in order to become famous is seriously deluded and misguided. It was very unexpected to get the kind of attention that I did. And I certainly wasn't prepared for it. I wasn't prepared to have waiters eavesdropping on my conversation and calling up tabloids. And it took some adjusting, too.
Now, in the preface to how it ended, you mentioned that you made some changes in looking at some of these older stories. You felt okay about tweaking things. What did you change? And did you change anything in that first story?
This story, I didn't change a thing.
Okay.
I sort of felt, the novel exists in a somewhat different form. I should mention that eventually, after I published this story in the Paris Review, this voice kind of stayed with me. And frankly, you know, the guy in the story is obviously kind of confused and unhappy, and it's not fully explained in the story why. We learn that his wife left him, but we don't learn why. We don't learn much about him beyond that. And so after the story came out, I sort of felt, you know, there's a lot more to tell here. And also I was kind of infatuated with that voice. And I kept going. And at some point somebody, my future editor told me that nobody wrote novels in the second person. It simply wasn't done and that I shouldn't even consider it. And so I actually tried to revise this and write it in the first person, write it in the third person. And somehow it didn't work very well. You know, a lot of the humor and the tension went out of the narrative. And so I just decided, despite conventional wisdom, to keep going and writing in the second person. But in the case of this story, for the book, I just decided to leave it the way. I just thought there was something about leaving it as written in that all-night session after George Plimpton's phone call. There are things that I did change for the novel, although not that much. Other stories, I just, you know, there were phrases that suddenly seemed a little off to me. I made minor changes, but nothing really extensive.
You got the screenwriting credit on the movie. Tell me about the leap from writing a novel, writing a short story, to going to the novel, to becoming a screenwriter.
I did get the, you know, I think the word is screen blame for that particular
okay.
movie rather than screen credit. I did write the screenplay, but I can't say that I'm really happy with the end result. It's funny. I was there every day. I got along well with the director and the actors, and it seemed like we were doing something worthwhile. But when I finally saw the end result, I felt it had missed an awful lot of what we were trying to do, and it missed an awful lot of what made the book special. I think that after the novel was published, there were two reasons why the people who bought the movie rights asked me to do the screenplay. One being that I was cheap, and I think they thought they didn't have much to lose. And I think maybe the other reason was that they thought, you know, this is a very strange narrative, and I guess they just thought maybe I had as good a chance as anyone of getting it down of translating it into film. In fact, I wrote a first draft, then several subsequent drafts, and then I was kicked off the project. And many, many other people were employed. There were many other screenplays. Tom Cruise for many, many weeks, or many years actually, was going to be the star. And they started filming with a director named Joyce Chopra in early 1988. And the producers saw what we call the dailies. They would review the film each day, and they were so unhappy with what they saw that they fired her and her husband, who was the new screenwriter, and hired a new director who read all of the drafts and decided that my first draft was the one he liked the best. So then I was called back on the project, and that was how I became the screenwriter. As I say, I wish I were prouder of the end result. I should mention that the movie is being remade this year, next year, by someone named Josh Schwartz, and I'm cautiously optimistic about that.
That's terrific. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with wine writer and author Jay McInerney. I'm Julia Flynn Seiler. You spent most of your career writing novels. Tell me a little bit about your return to the short story form for this book, and also, to what degree do you think we'll see a resurgence of short narrative as the world increasingly turns to Twittering and Facebook updates as a way to communicate?
In my own case, I had when I finished and published my last novel, The Good Life, in 2006, I don't know. On the one hand, I was kind of at loose ends. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And at the same time, I started reading a lot of short fiction. And one of the things I went back to the short stories of Raymond Carver, who was my teacher and mentor in graduate school, one of the great short story writers of the 20th century. He really was the guy that I credit with inspiring me to continue when I was just about ready to give up. I also was very lucky to have a teacher named Tobias Wolff, who came in the bargain when I enrolled at Syracuse University after getting fired from the New Yorker as a fact checker. At Syracuse, I was writing short stories. It's really hard to just sit down and dive into a novel when you're in your early 20s and you really don't know the craft. And I had these two great writers who were short story writers teaching me, and I always loved the form, but I wasn't sure if I really understood it. This first successful short story that I wrote grew into a novel, and subsequently I wrote another novel. But I kind of stuck with the story form. In between novels, I would write a story or two. I published a number of them over the years. And finally, when I finished this the seventh novel, I decided that I wanted to actually sit down and write an entire book of stories, or write a collection of stories. I was reading Carver, I was reading John Cheever, people like that, and it really excited me. And I thought, you know what, I want to see if I can master this form, or at least write some good stories. And I sat down in very short order. I wrote about 12 new short stories. The original idea was to publish these 12 as a volume. And then I think it was my editor who said, you know, why don't we collect your older stories with these as well? In the end, we have 26 stories here. I would love to think that I'm sort of in the vanguard somehow, or that I'm part of a shift in taste here. That is to say, it seems to me like the time is ripe for a revival of the short story. The story has been in decline for a while because of the disappearance of a lot of the traditional marketplaces. Magazines are closing, or they're no longer publishing fiction. You know, all of the great periods of the short story have coincided with a sort of vigorous and healthy magazine market. And that really almost disappeared in the 80s and 90s. But suddenly we're seeing all kinds of new digital platforms for literature, for journalism, and so on. And I think that it's quite possible that the short story form may be due for a renaissance.
Well, I certainly think that's one of the pleasures of this book, is to see your development over a long span of time as a writer and how you interweave themes and go back to certain characters. It's really, really fun. But I also have to tell you, I really enjoy your wine writing, which is even shorter, quite a bit shorter than your fiction stories. And I was particularly amused in Bacchus and Me, which was your first collected essays, wine essays, that when you began your adventure as a wine writer, you were somebody who had very low opinion of California wines. One of my favorite was in one of the early essays, you compared California Chardonnay to the women of Playboy in Beverly Hills. And I'm quoting you here, homogeneous voluptuosity, I'm not even sure how to pronounce that, which had more to do with technology than nature. And I think that's why you bring your wit to your wine writing.
I think Pamela Anderson was what I had in mind.
Yes.
It's true, though, that these early, the early days of California Cabernet and Chardonnay, there was a certain, first of all, there was... there was a ripeness which was all, in a sense, you know. There was a
Baywatch
certain lack
babes.
Baywatch babes. There was a certain lack of subtlety in many of these wines, and there was a natural evolution in the development of California wine, and we also it also has to be said that, you know, you're very lucky here in California. The grapes actually get ripe, which isn't always true in France. And in fact, when I got this job as the wine writer at House and Garden in 1996, the food editor of House and Garden, who was sort of nominally my boss, she's from the Bay Area, and she insisted that the first thing I do before I started this column was come to Napa and Sonoma and learn more about California wines. And it was, you know, it was an eye-opening experience.
Jay, I have to jump in here. I cannot resist asking this question. So which do you like better, Napa or Sonoma? This is a pressing concern amongst California wine people.
Well, gee, I hate to alienate half of my audience here.
Well,
but,
go ahead.
I'm gonna have to say, at present, Sonoma. 10 years ago, I would have said Napa, because my first love in California was the great Cabernets of these cult Cabernets that really appeared on the scene in the early 90s, like Harlan, like Colgan, like Bryant family, and so on. They were stupendous wines, and I still like those wines very much, but my palate has shifted a little bit toward Pinot Noir. Okay. And Sonoma is the home of the new Pinots, particularly the Russian River Valley and the Sonoma Coast. And I just love Pinots like there's lots of them, but Marcassin and Flowers, and there's Hirsch. There's many others. But you know, it's really a matter of taste. When I'm looking for a really powerful Cabernet Sauvignon, Napa is the only place to go. And it's still of its kind. There's nothing better than a Napa Valley Cabernet.
Very diplomatic. I like this.
Well, but as I say, Pinot is my default setting now.
I have to say that I also have enjoyed your wine writing because of the vicarious pleasure of accompanying you on your trips. And one of the favorite columns that you did was how you spent the millennium. Okay, so get this. He spends the millennium, a series of dinner parties, drinking some of the most fabulous wines on the planet with writers such as Julian Barnes, Jancis Robinson, Stephen Fry, a whole bunch of them. And I was stuck that evening, the actual evening of the millennium, at the Millennium Dome with Queen Elizabeth, the Prime Minister, and terrible wine, all drunk out of glasses just like this. So when I read what you were doing, I was very envious.
I wasn't that far away, but I was drinking much better than you were.
you were.
This actually started, this idea came about. I should mention that Julian Barnes, the English novelist, is a close friend of mine. We met in 1985, and he had just published Flaubert's Parrot, and I had just published Twilight's Big City, and we had the same publisher. And we met at my publisher's house and really hit it off. He invited me over to his house and served me two very old and wonderful Chateauneuf du Pape, which I never forgot. And he was sort of a year or two ahead of me in his sort of evolution as a wine geek and a lover of wine, and we started communicating. Our friendship coincided with the invention of the fax machine, so we would fax each other back and forth over the years, and we would visit in New York and in London, we obviously talked about literature and gossiped about the writers we knew and so on. But a lot of our friendship was based on wine. And somewhere around 95 or so, I conceived this idea that we would have a millennium dinner and we'd have 100-point Parker wines. But it just kind of grew, because then we decided, well, one night ought to be devoted to the Rhone, but what about, you know, then one night we decided would be California Cabernets, which I was in charge of. And then of course, we had to have a Bordeaux night. So we ended up having to spread it out over a week. And and we collected some friends along the way, like Jancis Robinson, who's one of the great wine critics.
She's a marvelous British wine critic. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with wine writer and author Jay McInerney. I'm Julia Flynn Seiler. Speaking of English writers, I understand you are a Jane Austen fan. Tell me what you like best about her writing.
Jane Austen, I mean, she's just a comic genius for one thing, and a master of understatement. I love this sort of, you know, the focus of her work. You know, it's really just about, family, love, marriage. You know, the things that really we all have in common.
Don't forget money.
And money. There you go.
Lack of money.
Yeah, actually, it's very much about money. I'm glad you straightened that out. And of course, in Jane Austen's novels, marriage and money are inextricably linked. And
yes.
I just reread all of them, I guess, in January and February. And it never gets old.
Well, it seems to me it'd be hard to find two writers, you and Jane Austen, who have led such wildly different lives. Could you describe for us a typical writing day for us, or maybe a typical day? You mentioned earlier that you're heading off to San Simeon this weekend.
That wouldn't be a typical writing day. my typical writing day is I get up at the crack of 8:30 or 9. And I try to get to my desk as quickly as possible because I think there is something about I like to be close to the state of sleep. That is to say, I don't like to be too far away from my dreams when I start writing, and I don't like to have a whole bunch of business intervene, and I don't like to have a whole bunch of emails. Intervene. Typically I write from about 9:30 to 1 or so. And if things are going well, and if one of my kids isn't sick, or if I don't have to give an interview or something, then I go back to my desk about 2:30 or so and write for another couple of hours. That's a typical writing day. Now, there are many days like today, like the last 3 weeks when I've been traveling around the country promoting my book when there's no routine but I've been writing on the road. I'm working on an introduction for a book of John Cheever's letters, and I'm writing an essay for an Italian literary magazine, and I'm also keeping my hand in with my new novel, which is about half finished.
Oh, congratulations. Now, in the period of your life when you were sleeping with a pig, did you get as much work done as you normally would? And no disrespect to asking the question, I just had to ask this question.
Well, if anything, the pig got me out of bed earlier. I should explain that my ex-wife had a pot-bellied pig, which was, I assumed that when the pig came along that it was an outdoor pet. I mean, it seemed like a reasonable assumption. She kind of tricked me in terms of this pig. She was friends with Kevin Costner, who had his 40th birthday about 15 years ago. And she sent him a baby pig for his 40th birthday, with the instructions that if he couldn't use it, he could send it back. And of course, he was going off to shoot Waterworld or something like that. And so he had to send the pig back. So I think this is her way of getting herself a pig after I said that I didn't want to have a pig. And the pig, instead of going outside as all good pigs should, it became an indoor pet. And there came a point where she built a ramp up to, so the pig could climb up into the bed.
And,
yeah. I don't think this, I think that was the beginning of the end of that marriage.
Well, that brings me to my next question. When you base certain stories on real characters, ex-wives and lovers, for instance, don't they get a little upset with you when the stories are published? Specifically from this collection, mm-hmm. Sleeping with Pigs and Penelope on the Pond.
Well, I should say that the rule whenever you're basing a character on a real on a real life person is first of all to describe them as being very good looking, and that always helps. But my ex-wife did read this story, and I think that she felt it was just. You know, I don't know if she loved it, but she felt that insofar as it reflected on real events, that I hadn't been unfair. The other story you're referring to is based on a character that I wrote about some 20 years ago. The character's name is Allison Poole, and she was based on a young woman I dated some years before, and she reappeared in my life 3 or 4 years ago, and she moved back to New York, and then she disappeared again, and she was in fact having an affair with a prominent politician. And when she disappeared, I had a pretty good idea that she was having this affair, and that was all I knew. And so I returned to this character of Allison Poole, and I sort of speculated. I tried to imagine where she was and what she was doing, and that was how that story came about. I hadn't been in touch with her for many months. Then she reappeared in the National Enquirer and other media outlets. Not to be coy about this, this is a woman who was alleged to have an affair with John Edwards. I had a pretty good idea of what was going on, but I thought it was more interesting not to know too much. You know, Henry James used to get a lot of his ideas, particularly for short stories, at dinner parties, and often he would tell people, he would leave the table or block his ears because he didn't want to hear too much, because he wanted his imagination to have room to move. And in the case of this character, I had her hiding out in a cabin in the rural South. And it turned out she was in a sort of gated community somewhere with one of his staffers, but I like my version better.
Well, and Allison Poole also turned up in Bret Easton Ellis's. Ah, yeah.
This character has had a very colorful fictional life. My friend Bret Easton Ellis really, really liked this novel, Story of My Life, and he really liked this character of Allison Poole, so much so that he put her in his book American Psycho, which is about the terrible psycho killer Patrick Bateman. And I was indignant that Allison Poole was almost killed by his fictional killer. Fortunately, she wasn't killed. And then she reappeared later at great length in his book Glamorama. And I think this is partly Brett's way of sort of thumbing his nose at the critics who say that we are somehow interchangeable. I think, you know, this was his way of extending the joke, as it were.
I thought we'd go ahead and start with some questions. They're great questions. Here's one. What are the stories closest to your heart in this new book, and why?
Well, one of the stories, I'll always have a special fondness for the first story at 6 a.m. Do You Know Where You Are? Because it was my first story. And I love that voice, and I love it when a voice sort of is self-generating and does most of the work for you as a writer. There's two other stories that I'm very fond of in this book. The new stories that I like very much. One is called The Madonna of Turkey Season, which is about a family which is sort of bereft by the death of the mother and sort of. It's a succession of Thanksgivings, a series of vignettes about Thanksgiving when the boys, the sons, and the father who are left to celebrate their holidays without their mother, sort of pass around a kind of ceremonial torch each year. Each year, somebody drinks too much and behaves really badly.
I thought that was a marvelous story, and probably everyone who's ever had a big family Thanksgiving gathering can deeply feel that.
That I don't know why that one is. That one is close to my heart, and the other one that I like is the last, or the other one that I'm fondest of at the moment is the last story in the collection, which is called The Last Bachelor, and it's about a New York playboy who has a 25-year career as a bon vivant and a man about town, and it's about the final days before he finally settles down to get married, very very reluctantly, and I don't know. To me, it kind of just it summarizes in a relatively short span the 25 years or so that I've lived in Manhattan.
Here's another question. You led a wild life for a time. Is there anything you regret or would do differently?
Is there anything I regret? Well, there's lots and lots of things I regret. I certainly would have kept a lower profile if I had known how cumulatively it can add up very quickly, and one can become kind of overexposed. Norman Mailer, who is not very good at keeping a low profile and who became a good friend of mine over the years, we were once walking into a movie premiere together, and the flash bulbs were going madly. It was me and Norman and his beautiful wife, Norris. And as these paparazzi were blasting away at us, he looked at me and said, "Watch out, Jay, those flash bulbs can bleach your soul." And it was actually a very, very apt and wise thing to say, although there he was in the middle of it all, you know. There have been very few authors more exposed than Norman. But, I think that would be my central regret, is that I would like to have preserved a little more of a sense of mystery, I think.
Okay, the next question has to do with the movie. I think Michael J. Fox said the remake of Bright Lights, Big City would be difficult for audiences to get into today because we're far removed from the days of 24-hour cocaine-fueled New York life. What do you think about that?
Well, I read something where Michael J. Fox was pretty gracious about this new one. I think he feels, too, that we didn't quite get it right. But I beg to differ from Michael in that he and I are not living that life anymore. But every 21-year-old that comes to New York, some of them with a copy of that book in their hands, is kind of living that life. I wish that
the drugs are different.
No, the drug. I mean, there are other drugs, but I have to say that in my observation, there's just as much cocaine in New York and cities like it as there ever was. I dated a five or six years ago. I dated a woman in her early 30s, and all of her friends seemed to be doing the exact same things that we were doing in 1982 and 1983. So I think Michael is speaking more of a generational pattern of behavior than he is any significant shift in the behavior of young people.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with wine writer and author Jay McInerney. I'm Julia Flynn Seiler. Next question. Do you write your books with the thought and hopes of having them made into a movie?
No, I never think about the movie aspect when I'm writing, and I think that would be really deadly. Anybody who's writing with the movies in mind is probably writing genre fiction, you know, thrillers being the most obvious example, romantic comedies, I suppose. But I think it's really important. If I had wanted to be in the movies, I would have gone to film school, and I would have become a director rather than a writer. I fell in love with the novel and the short story, and I still think that fiction is, you know, for me, the most profound aesthetic experience. I don't want to denigrate film and movies, but at the same time, they are secondary to me and to my intentions. And I never think about this until after I've finished something. I certainly hope that I'm always looking for the check, you know, the option check. And if nothing else, a film always brings more readers to the book. You know, there's a great example. Last year, Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet made this movie of one of my favorite novels, Revolutionary Road. Revolutionary Road had probably sold about 12,000 copies in the last 50 years. And suddenly, you know, it sold 1 million copies last year because of this film. Now, the film wasn't very successful, but hundreds of thousands of people have read the book because of the movie.
You were talking earlier about the importance of voice, and you found your voice in that little, I keep on imagining that slip of paper in your desk that you got 4 a.m. or whatever it was. But is there a book you've read recently where you were startled by the voice in the perhaps the same way that second person narrator in Bright Lights startled readers?
There is a book I read recently by a new young writer that I thought had a very assured and commanding voice, and it's a writer named Wells Tower, wrote a book of short stories called Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned. And there's two or three stories there that are really masterly. And one of them, curiously enough, is in the second person, about a teenage boy, which I think is very good. And the title story is amazing. It's about these Vikings who sail over to England to pillage and burn. And it's an extraordinary little narrative. I'm always looking for that kind of thing. A few years ago, I found a book by a writer named Benjamin Kunkel called Indecision, which I think had a really, really strong voice. I reviewed it for the New York Times. And I think that, you know, the people in their 20s are the people who really do kind of reinvent the way we look at the world, or the people who give us news about what's actually happening now in the culture in a way that older writers can't. It's not to say that people in their 20s are the greatest writers, but I'm always looking for that fresh, new take on the world.
Here's a question that's very sweet. I miss House and Garden, mainly because I so enjoyed your wine articles. Do you have any other plans to publish future wine essays? And has anyone approached you to publish wine writing, further publish your wine writing?
I would love to go back to wine writing. I'm waiting for somebody who can afford me to come forward. And I actually had just made an agreement with a publication called Men's Vogue, for whom I wrote a piece last year, and they promptly folded. likewise, I was talking with a publication called Best Life, which then folded as well. So I don't know. I'm afraid that I bring something of a curse to this, but I'm sure I'm going to find another outlet for my wine writing before too long. I think I just want to finish this next novel, though. It has been nice to really concentrate on fiction again, which really is my métier. I think you want to say author and wine writer instead of wine writer and author. But
of course, you're right.
I did love it. I mean, it was something. It was just a hobby that I was going to do it for a year, and I ended up doing it for 12 years. And it was extraordinary. You know, visiting some of the most beautiful parts of the world, and hanging out with people who are happy all the time. You know, the literary world is so sort of, it's so competitive and backbiting. And the wine world is great. They all live in beautiful places. They all have a buzz on. They're eating the best food in the world. That's like, you know, what's not to love about being in the wine world, you know.
My experience with the wine world was a little different in terms of of happiness of the families that I met there.
Well, yeah, it's true. But you found one of the great dramatic stories of the wine world, and that's maybe not as happy as some of the stories that I have to tell.
Yeah. I would agree, however, that it's an enormously generous industry in terms of embracing people, and you know, wine is lovely. So here's a question related to your fiction writing. How do you approach your fiction writing? Do you have a well-formed idea before you begin, or do you just let the words appear on the page?
I always have some kind of idea, and sometimes it's a voice, and sometimes it's a character, and sometimes it's a situation. In terms of short stories, I'll give you an example. My wife, Anne, told me a story from... She said that she seemed to remember in her youth a couple who... she was Jewish, and the wife was Jewish, and the husband was Catholic. And in her memory, at least, she said every time that he had an affair, she had an abortion. And I thought, wow, that's an amazing, like, tell me more. And unfortunately, she didn't remember that much more of the story, but I just thought, now there's a short story there. You got to, you know, that's a situation. You got to run with that. Sometimes it's a voice, like in the case of Story of My Life, Alison Poole was based on this this young woman that I was 30, she was 21, and I used to sit around and listen to her friends talk about life, and they had this crazy sort of Valley Girl dialect that I found kind of fascinating, and then that was, I just kind of ran with that voice. I wish that I was somebody who had a whole story in my mind, you know, John Irving, Bret Easton Ellis, F. Scott Fitzgerald, all these writers, you know, outline and they know exactly where they're going by the time they sit down to write the actual prose. But for me, it's more like driving at night. You know, I can only see as far as the headlights.
That said, I have to say, it's 6 a.m. That was a beautifully structured story, in turn, I thought. And it's amazing that it came out in a rush in, you know, a few hours or
a day. Yes, usually it's more trial and error. Usually there's like several drafts before I really hit it.
Yeah. This is a question that relates to some of the semi-autobiographical or autobiographical characters you've written about. Has anyone ever become angry with you over how they were portrayed?
You know, surprisingly, I mean, less than you would think. I've actually had people claim to be characters in my books who weren't characters in my book. I did have one. I mean, the only incident that I really can say somebody got angry at me. My brother Chris was unhappy with a memoir that I wrote in the New Yorker about 10 years ago, and it was a memoir about my mother. And I think that, you know, first of all, our memories differed on a lot of crucial points. It was interesting. I mean, you know, things that I was certain about, he was equally certain had never happened. But likewise, you know, he didn't agree with my decision to write about it, about my mother at all. She had died when I was 24, so it was a long, you know, it was a long time before my father had also passed away. I can understand that. In my fiction, not so much. It's funny. I think, you know, I think a lot of people are flattered to be portrayed at all. And as I say, it always helps to say they're good looking. I do have a friend who was very upset with, she felt that she was in my last novel, The Good Life, and she was really upset because the character was described as being merely pretty, and she felt that she was better looking than that. And well, she's actually a well-known novelist. But
that's funny. Well, I have to say, I felt as a parent myself wince a little bit in the portion that was so funny of the Thanksgiving story, in which the mother talks about how she gave the dad a hand job, and that's led to the proposal that evening. And I was like, oh, no.
Now, so that wasn't the Thanksgiving. That,
oh,
that
sorry,
was the
confused.
Story called Philomena.
Oh, Philomena, no. Sorry.
Which, yeah.
Well, I hope. Was that based
not
on?
That, no, certainly God, my.
Okay.
Certainly not my family. We did not. We did not talk like that. My mother, ooh, most of all. No.
Okay. Okay.
No, this
just
is
had to clear that up, Jay.
No. Fortunately, not remotely. Nothing remotely resembling my family in that story.
Okay.
No, actually, and I have to say that short stories for me are more of an opportunity to get outside of myself. I mean, there are a couple of these stories that are somewhat autobiographical, but most of them are really, you know, things that I've overheard at parties or that friends have told me, and they tend to be less drawn from my own life than the novels do, I think.
Mm-hmm. When this is another question from the audience, when not writing, how do you like to spend your time, and do you have any other aspirations?
How do I like to spend my time? Well, I love to travel. You know, I love eating and drinking. Honestly, I mean, last night we got to go to Michael Mina, you know, which is
how was that?
Which was terrific. I love to fish. But in my older age, I'm becoming more and more devoted to fly fishing for trout and for bonefish, most specifically. I love to ski. I've returned to tennis after a long hiatus, and I like to, I guess most of all, I like to spend time with my friends.
Yeah, all wonderful. Many authors, this is another question, many authors say they want to write a great book. Do you have thoughts of writing such a book, or do you think maybe you've done it already?
Well, I think I think everybody, all of us, would like to write a great book. I wish I had written The Great Gatsby. I'm always hoping that my masterpiece is the next one or the one after that, and I don't think I've written it yet. So I'm
cool.
I'm hopeful that it will, you know, my third or fourth novel, hence, will be the great one.
Who are your heroes, your all-time literary heroes?
Well, F. Scott Fitzgerald is really one of my favorite writers. You know, in earlier days, I might have been more inclined to say Hemingway, but, you know, over time, I think Fitzgerald sort of wears better with me and seems to be more in tune with the American experience. And I really was very much under the thrall of James Joyce for many years. Reading Ulysses just kind of blew my mind. I just thought, wow, it's just this incredible, it's like a textbook for every single literary technique known to man, and a sort of compendium of Western mythology at the same time. Carver remains for me very important, and Edith Wharton is a writer who I've become much more in tune with in later years. I don't think I even read Edith Wharton until I was 30 or so. I remember being forced to read Ethan Frome when I was in eighth grade and not liking it much then. It's not a very characteristic novel anyway, but she's one of the great chroniclers of New York society, and more and more, she's on her way to becoming my favorite writer, I think.
Yeah, right. I mean, that was such a wonderful Gilded Age portrayal, a writer.
Yeah, I mean, House of Mirth is hard to beat.
Oh, I agree. I wonder, given the financial crisis we're in, given where you're located in New York and the people that you spend time with, there seems to me to be an incredible opportunity to write about this moment in time. Have you thought about, in a sense, financial writing?
I'm writing at this moment, I'm writing about someone who was in the financial world and had a terrible fall. Actually, in the last financial crisis, this sort of the dot-com telecom collapse. Someone who lost it all back in 2001, who reinvents himself, leaves Manhattan and reinvents himself as on Long Island. I started writing it last July, and I didn't realize how timely it would come to seem, perhaps. But I think it's amazing what is happening in our country right now, and in New York in particular. And as much as I feel badly for those who have lost their jobs, who are losing their retirement funds and so on, I think it's an extraordinary moment to observe and. And I also think there's a kind of necessary corrective here. I mean, Manhattan had become such a playground of the rich, and there was a kind of heedlessness to the consumption, and I think there was a sort of loss of any sense of value beyond the accumulation of wealth, and I think we're undergoing a painful but necessary correction, and as a novelist, it's going to be really interesting to observe. Mm.
Perhaps you're writing the Great Gatsby of 2000,
It would be nice
whatever.
To think so. Uh-huh. As Hemingway said, wouldn't it be pretty to think so?
right. And this is a kind of odd question, but interesting one. What's your history with Japan, Jay? And is it still a source of inspiration for you?
Well, I went to Japan after I graduated from Williams. I actually applied for a Princeton program, which took me to Japan. And I think the reason there were several reasons I did that, but one of them was that in 1977, it seemed like the zeitgeist was kind of asleep here in the United States. I mean, there wasn't. It was a weird time, There wasn't. It was hard to feel what was going on. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, except that I wanted to write. And I had a roommate from college who was over there and who told me that you could teach English and live very well without expending a great deal of effort. And I'd always been intrigued by certain aspects of Japanese culture, by Zen, by the martial arts, Japanese painting, and it was somewhat a crime of opportunity. I didn't quite know what I was doing, and I felt I could have a lot of time to write there. But I ended up staying 2 years, and it was a formative experience for me. I think as the years go by, less so. But it certainly was the genesis of my second novel, Ransom. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question. And I think that I've gone through most of the questions from the audience, so I'm going to selfishly ask it myself. Mm. And I think we'll have to go back to wine writing.
All right.
Could you describe, I think most people have a particular bottle of wine, a particular glass of wine, a moment that was so wonderful you'll never forget it. Could you describe that moment for us, perhaps, over a bottle of wine?
At the risk of sounding very esoteric, for me it was the wine from my birth year. And
1955.
1955, La Mission Aubryon, and I remember it quite well. It was actually, I believe, my 40th birthday, and I was at the house of a guy who's certainly being generous that night, whose name was Teddy Forsman, at his apartment in New York, surrounded by a fairly impressive art collection. He used to date my ex-wife, and that was how I found myself at his apartment. But it was an extraordinary bottle of wine. It was full of these incredible secondary notes. I sometimes describe the ideal Aubryon, La Mission Aubryon, as sort of smelling like a hot brick on a on a sweaty saddle with a cigar on the side, and it was, you know, it had all of those elements, tobacco and leather and tar, but it was incredible. It was just a very, very profound wine, and it made me extremely happy. And I've had one or two bottles since then, but that was probably the best bottle of wine.
That's a marvelous,
I can remember.
Marvelous description. Sweaty tobacco cigars, yum. Our thanks to Jay McInerney, author and wine writer, and his most recent collection of short stories, How It Ended. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program is part of our Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Julia Flynn Seiler, author of The House of Mondavi, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.